Can we let go of the past entirely? Right in this moment. And can we let go of the future entirely right in this moment? And simply be here with things exactly as they are. And if you ask yourself, well, okay, but for how long? The answer would be, of course, for now. Just for now. And now. And even now. Here's a poem for you to simply hear as best you can and open to as best you can. It's 900 years old and it comes from the Sufi tradition and in fact from Jalaluddin Rumi, many of you know it. This being human is a guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every moment a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out. She may be cleaning you out. For some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, greet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. This being human is a guest house. Every moment a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. She may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, greet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. You don't have to laugh, that's advanced practice. Greet them at the door, laughing, smiling, frowning, and invite them in. Grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So this morning we finished exploring the arc of the meditative instructions as we offer them in mindfulness-based intervention. Whole range of objects that we have taken as the kind of primary focus of our attention to cultivate greater focus, greater stability, greater vividness, and greater clarity in relationship to even one object, say the breath. And we've certainly discovered that it's not so easy to pay attention to anything because so much competes for our attention and we are so easily distracted and self-distracting. And I think it's probably fair to say that we've all sort of been cooking in that stew and realizing the size of the cloth, how challenging it is to be present for even a fraction of a second. And to be in our bodies a lot of the time, the body long gone, we just like off someplace. And then we've been exploring, of course, the potential to not simply cultivate one object of attention, but to hold a field of multiple changing objects in awareness with a certain degree of stability and clarity and awareness of the ever-changing nature of everything, the law of impermanence, that whatever is here is not going to be here that long, including us, that everything is continually changing, and it's virtually a prescription to suffer, to cling to and insist that things be the way they have been, or the opposite, if we don't like the way things are, to cling to insisting that they be different from the way they are. And sometimes we joke that, you know, how come it is that when we like something and we cling to it, it seems to never last. But when we don't like something and we really want it to go away, it seems to last forever. You know, is there an asymmetry in the law of impermanence? And of course there isn't. It's all continually changing, but how attached we are to one particular thing or another can actually invite things to get stuck and not change. And so we often unwittingly perpetuate our own suffering even though we see the way out. And we do that through our endless, highly conditioned habits of mind and of relating to everything, including ourselves, or our concepts, our narratives about ourselves. So I would like to actually invite us to reflect on these last two practices that were offered this morning. The awareness of the focusing on thoughts and feelings as actual objects of attention. And then this objectless practice of choiceless awareness, where it's not that there are no objects, but we no longer choose to focus our attention on any particular object, but to basically rest in what's variously called open presence or choiceless awareness or there are many, many different ways to speak of objectless awareness. Open presence is a good way to put it, or choiceless awareness. Before we do that, there are a few elements that I'd like to revisit or loop back to. One is the whole question of pain that came up last night, and your questioning about your knee. And my responses went in a particular direction, in part because it was the knee and the way you described it. And, you know, pain is a gigantic problem in medicine, and medicine has very few resources to bring to most chronic pain conditions. But knees and hips, medicine actually does have some very effective interventions for. So we spoke about that, you know, in the case that one eventually that nothing can be done about the pain, and sooner or later maybe repair could be a valuable option. But there, most of the kinds of pain we experience, repair is not possible, or it's very risky and very iffy, and very often leads to more pain. So the other piece of this is, well, how do we work with pain where there are no good options for medical treatment or surgical intervention or something that kind of fixes it or takes it away? And as I said, there are very few fixes in medicine, and of course the ones that there are really important to avail ourselves of if we need them. So you've probably noticed that now that we've started to pay attention to thoughts as events in the field of awareness, that, well, how many of you have run into during the course of just this morning some degree of discomfort in the body? Raise your hands if you just look around. Okay. So we have a laboratory here, a very rich laboratory for experimenting with how we're going to be in relationship to this. And of course, for most of us, if we got up and walked, it would disappear, right? It's a pain that is in part due to the sitting itself, that it's uncomfortable to sit. Sometimes, you know, if we sit for a long period of time, that discomfort really builds. And then you can actually pay attention to the narrative, what's going on when we are hurting. So I wonder if you notice that there's a whole sort of panoply of thinking that goes along with intense physical sensation. Did you notice that? Did that become part of your experience this morning? That you might have all sorts of thoughts about it, like, why am I doing this? That's one thought. Why am I doing this? My knee is killing me, or my back is killing me. Well, that's another thought. My back is killing me. I can't stand this any longer. That's another thought. What are some of the thoughts that you had? Just shout them out.
When will this be over?
Oh, yeah. Has he fallen asleep? When are those bells going to ring? This is going to really damage my knee permanently. I'll never walk again. Okay. Or run. Okay.
I will not be able to ride home.
To drive home. Okay. Any other thoughts that you noticed came up around discomfort, intense discomfort? You have ants on your skin. Okay. So, perfect, yeah. Shout it out. Right. If I was only doing it right, I would be pain-free. Some version of that. Okay, so here we have it. Tons of thoughts associated with the sensations, okay? Now, I think I said yesterday that even choosing to call these sensations pain is a choice, and it's a thought. When we say the word pain, there's a whole constellation of thought associated with the very word, I'm in pain. Okay, and it carries a lot of weight with it.
Okay, so what was a sensation someplace in the body, now we're building on top of this sensation. And one of the things we're building is a whole thought construction. And then what else, aside from thought, what else did you notice about the moments that you were in intense discomfort?
I lose my peace.
You lost your peace of mind, totally.
Preoccupied.
Fear.
It kills me, really. It's like a killer. It's like sick, really.
It what?
I'm agitated.
Agitated, okay. It's agitation. So these are emotions. Okay, so there's, and in the pain literature is described this way, there's this sort of somatic aspect of the experience of pain. Then there's the cognitive aspect, which is all of our thoughts about it. That contributes to the experience of pain. And then there's the emotion around it. Okay? And you describe them very, very clearly.
Yeah, I was trying to get free, really. I was trying to go back all the time.
Always trying to get back to...
Yeah, and free from fear.
Free from fear.
And I was trying to get balance. In all
to find some kind of balance.
It's been going through all the
retreats. Yeah.
And I couldn't. It was like a wave.
So waves of pain and emotion and cognition and sensation.
Like, you know, for right. Seconds, like balance, and then
balance gone.
Yeah.
And then you, again,
yeah.
Little moments of balance. That's why the practice of brief moments many times is real. So one thing that you might do when that arises is, let's say the thought is, I'm sitting here and something feels like it's on fire. And then the thought floats through the mind, this is killing me. Okay? So you can actually hold that in awareness and recognize that's not the pain. Okay? That's a thought. That's not the sensation. It's a thought about the whole constellation of sensations. Okay, so here's a question. Is it even true? In this moment, you can ask yourself, sitting here, everything's going on that we just said was going on, and the thought arises, this is killing me. So you can ask yourself, is that true? And usually if you look right in that moment, is this killing me? The answer is no. It's not killing me. But then the next question is, how long will I be able to stand it? So we bring in the future. And you see, once you've brought in the future, all bets are off. Because this is about the present moment. So you could say, is this killing me? No. Next moment. It's killing me. Is this killing me? Now? No. Now? No. Now? No. Well, if you add up all those nows, sometime the bell will ring. And you will not have been killed. And you might even notice that when you answer that question, is this killing me? Now. Right now. And the answer is, you look and you see and you feel, and the answer is no. What happens to the experience that we call pain? And what happens to the suffering that we so tightly link to the intense sensations that we call pain? This is where the investigation comes in. It's not like we're telling you what the landscape is like. We get to investigate what the landscape is like, explore for ourselves. This whole constellation of thinking, emotions, and sensation, how do they work together? How do they work together? And you can investigate that. And so then your little laboratory cushion here then becomes a really interesting environment for understanding some of the ways in which we create suffering. We actually create the suffering, and then we blame it on me, okay? Because I haven't rung the bells yet, so you can blame it on me, or you can blame it on yourself. Why did I come to this stupid retreat? How can this possibly be useful in medicine or in schools or in any other environment, corporate environment. This is like just stupid. We're not doing anything. It's killing me. And we go out, we walk like zombies, Night of the Living Dead, and we come back in, more pain. You know, it's like, what is the point?
Yes.
A lot of struggle. Could we get the microphones going here, Ron? Thank you. But please pronounce it.
The question was to move or not move.
Yes, to move or not to move. Yes. Famous Shakespearean question.
That was the struggle.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
And how did it go? You just shifted your posture.
Without knowing it.
Yeah, okay, so you could shift without knowing it and then be aware of it afterwards.
Hated the struggle.
Yeah.
The struggle was painful.
And the struggle itself was painful on top of the discomfort in the body, right? And now let me ask you a question. Did moving help? After a few minutes, it didn't help. It's like, all I need to do is move my knee, shift it, and you know the pain will go away.
But then it struggled.
Then you struggle. Because you want to be a good yogi, right? Good student. The tough ones that, you know, and of course, if you've been in the army, so, you know, we don't flinch, we just, so there's a kind of macho way to relate to all this. That's not what's being suggested. What's being suggested is a real gentle, loving way to put out the welcome mat for the sensations, and then investigate whether the sensations are actually suffering at all, whether that is what suffering is. And you can look and ask yourself and penetrate right into the sensation and notice how the mind wants to inflame it, the thoughts will inflame it. Call it pain, it's different. Call it just, don't call it anything. This feeling in the knee, or in the back, or in the shoulders, or in the face, or wherever it is. And when you don't name it, you're more in the sensory domain of simply awareness of this. Just like the sounds that we're not calling birds. The sensations that we're not calling anything. They're just how it is in the knee in this moment. And then you can see what the thoughts do to create suffering. What the emotions do to compound suffering. And they kind of link and they work together. And one of the things that mindfulness does is it uncouples what's called the sensory dimension of pain from the cognitive dimension of pain, from the affective dimension of pain. And now we can actually do studies in fMRI scanners and see what's going on in the brain. And in fact, different areas can shut down when you practice in this kind of a way. It's not like you're not experiencing the sensation, but you're not turning it into pain and inflaming it, and then from pain to suffering. This is not to deny that sometimes we are in serious pain and we can suffer. But when we investigate it in the laboratory like this, then even when we are, you know, really in pain where getting up and walking is not going to do anything to it. And a lot of our patients are like that. They're just in pain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. How you are going to be in relationship to it is something where you have an enormous degree of freedom and agency. But if you just want it to be fixed, it's very hard to find a repair shop that is going to repair and fix and make go away everything that we're suffering. Yeah. Well, are you finished with? Okay, thank you. Yeah, just bring it over here. Where's the other microphone? Did it go anywhere? Okay.
I've been investigating myself for quite a while, and I already understand. I'm kind of a result that comes from a man. That's it. It's an amazing topic to treat. Kind of with a whole bunch of things that really came up. And the only thing that really helped was awareness and not acting upon the will of that. And whatever will be, this will.
So that's not passive, is it? You're saying whatever will be, but that's actually a very active stance to take. Okay, whatever, let whatever comes, come, but you're going to hold it in awareness without either making a big story about it and struggle around it. This is a very radical act, actually. And it is, I've come to see it as a radical act of wisdom, a radical act of sanity, and ultimately a radical act of love and kindness towards yourself, because anything else you discover by experimenting is going to cause suffering. Can you hear? Or did she need to speak louder into the mic? You can hear? Okay.
Also, the need to be controlled, illusionary things that I have control,
yeah.
I can't control, and I have just the range of conditions around. I just thought this whole thing very clearly that I have to arrange the conditions, and then
right,
try,
and then
you'll be, and trying to arrange it, and to see how still of my mind all the time. This is really, I think, just for this.
So I just want to make sure I understand. What you're saying is, when you're trying to control everything and arrange the conditions so that it's always right, that's a prescription for more suffering.
Yes, more
okay.
fear,
more
fear, more fear.
Right. And when you stop trying to arrange it...
Let it be. And I already found out that reality always comes. It doesn't matter what happens.
Reality always...
Kind.
Kind. That's also a good observation. If that comes. Okay. Let's just take that in for a moment. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that you have some kind of insight into our grasping for a certain kind of control actually compounds the suffering. And if we allow ourselves to be bigger and say, okay, just let whatever arise, arise, whatever arises, arise. In a sense, you're exercising control, but in a much bigger and more effective way. It's not like you're abandoning the field. It's that you're taking responsibility for things in a much bigger way. And what I want to point out is that this can sound passive, but there's nothing passive about it. It's neither active nor passive. Okay? So it's not like, oh, just be passively resigned to whatever arises. That way you just become a victim of circumstances. But if you're always trying to arrange the things so that things work out for you, that's also problematic. We sometimes joke that it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, you know? And we're very busy rearranging the deck chairs, but it's the Titanic. The whole ship is going down. So sometimes those kinds of efforts are really wasted energy. And what can we, how can we mobilize our energy wisely? Do you want to say anything else?
Yeah, it's like, I never
did anything. Lying.
Lying down? Yes. So the whole thing was weird from the beginning. And I think
thank you. Anybody else on the subject of pain or discomfort? I think that's what we're on at the moment. So where you have a microphone? Wonderful. Then go for it.
I'd like to ask about painful thoughts. That are not related to pain in the body.
Yeah.
Like, And you talked before about the things that we seem to, that we have to change. And I'm thinking about, I'm avoiding this conflict. So these are the kind of things I'm thinking about. But I think any group in society that is suffering from real issues in, like, no housing, no whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so for me as an activist, there is a very strong thought that I have to change that.
Yeah.
And I guess for people who are in these conditions, they have a very strong thought about how do I get out of this. And I wonder what they have to say to that. And also, I know that in NDCT, there is some work with specific thoughts that are leading to negative.
Yes. In fact, they would invite it in, and you kind of role play to yourself, imagining a triggering scenario that generates suffering of some kind. And you actually invite it to happen and then attempt to get it in your way. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. Yeah. So either they're naturally or
you create it. Yeah. Yeah. It's always here naturally. But it's true that in MBCT they do that. We don't tend to do that in MBSR because we have so many stories that are, you know, the real thing. We can have it in real time rather than try to remember back to and evoke that kind of sadness. But when you're working with people with depression, but an MBCT is usually not with people who are actively depressed. They were depressed, and then they are no longer depressed because of either drug therapy or cognitive therapy, and the MBCT is to prevent relapsing back into depression. So they, in some sense, they have to kind of ask people to remember what it was like and to generate that sad feeling and then find a new way to be in relationship to it.
I guess that's what I'm asking about because it makes really, really strong thoughts that when you cling to them, it looks, this is the whole truth and there's nothing.
That's right.
For example, there is a common thought in Israel that Iran is going to attack us and there's going to be a second Holocaust.
Yeah.
And sometimes people are so strongly in that belief that like, you can't tell them it's not true. Mm-hmm. How do you know it's not true?
Yeah.
Don't you know?
You don't know that it's true, and you don't know that it's not true. So part of it is that the not knowing, I've said this several times, but we haven't gone into it in depth, but the not knowing becomes a very powerful way to be in relationship to experience. Because when you are convinced that you know, and it brings a huge amount of fear, then how you are going to respond to the threat is potentially very different and could actually make the situation much, much worse. I'll give you an example from just a few weeks ago. I don't know if you follow world news here, but there was a time earlier in April when North Korea was threatening nuclear holocaust on South Korea and whatever distance their missiles could reach American bases in the Pacific. And they, day after day after day, at a very, very high level, that they have not done in a long time, they threatened to just unleash nuclear war. It's like pretty intense. Well, it turns out, although most people didn't realize that, that the American Army and Navy and the South Korean Army and Navy were engaged in a month-long war game that they were actually going, and the North Koreans were very threatened by that. And when their level of, like, feverish, you know, talk about striking first, about attacking, reached a certain kind of pitch, the American military actually, without any publicity, just backed off. We were sending B-2 stealth bombers from the United States over South Korea. And you can imagine, I mean, North Korea's got
lots of problems, and you can imagine how paranoid and how freaked out and so forth they were. But also, it could be strategic. They're doing this, they do it very badly, and they do it for all sorts of reasons. The country is like, you know, in abject poverty, and they have nuclear weapons, and, you know, and they have a gigantic army, and everybody's starving. So how do we understand that? So one week, you know, it's nuclear war, and the next week it's like back to business as usual. It's probably very similar in most geopolitical things, that there's all this stuff going on, and you never know what's true, and you don't know how close we are ever to anything at all. But I think that it's really important that our leaders know how little they really know, because if you act on the basis of knowing, and I think there's, you know, I don't want to get into all sort of Israeli and Middle East politics, because it's a kind of endless, and I don't know anything about it, but, you know, very often leaders, after they have had their time in power, have an entirely different view on things than when they were in power. And I think what we need is mindful leadership. We need wise, passionate, clear leadership. Does that mean not strong? No, it doesn't mean it means really strong. But really strong means sometimes backing off, just the way the Americans did. Americans are not into backing off. But here, I was actually very pleasantly surprised to sort of, you know, find out that the American military just kind of, without publicity, just sort of cut it back. Because they could see what it was doing. And I think that in any kind of conflict, there's all of that kind of stuff going on. There's also the stories, the narratives that we tell ourselves. Okay? And I was speaking with Stephen Holder the other day. I know you know him, right? And
yes, and I think also, I don't necessarily want to take this into the political.
Yeah.
That's why I'm thinking about Colin Ayo, who is from the group that are struggling to have a public housing meter.
Public
housing.
Housing.
Has been really bad in recent few years.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of people who live on the street, and they have no future. They know that unless they manage to change something in the government, they're not going to have housing. So, and
is that so? Is that actually so? There's no private option?
For them, it is. Yes.
Why are there no private options?
Because
of the laws?
Well, I don't know
the story. Okay, the reason I mentioned it is because, you know, if you Google Greystone, G-R-E-Y-S-T-O-N, you know the work of, what's that?
Bernie
Glassman. He created his own public housing. You know, he created a community in a very, very poor part of New York, outside of New York City, called Yonkers. And they created an entire community that took care of the homeless. They didn't wait for the U.S. government to do it. They just did it.
He himself was privileged, and he was able to create the opportunity.
Yeah, but there are all sorts of people who are privileged in this society who create opportunities. So I think, come back to your original question about the conflict. Usually what happens in conflict is that we create stories, we create narratives about what is so. It would be very helpful to actually examine those narratives from the perspective of mindfulness and ask ourselves, are those narratives actually so, or are they only partly so, and partly there's a lot of open space where things could be different. And so, change the, you know, the potential is to change the narrative. And when I asked Stephen about, you know, just what was going on here, he said to me, he felt like the core problem is, if, you know, all the problems are going on, the core problem is the narrative. The people are attached to the narrative. What's that?
They believe
in the narrative, and they're very attached to it. So that might be a point of opening. I mean, I don't think anyone has the answer, like, what is the most effective way to always work with, you know, conflicting views and situations and very difficult, you know, conditions. But I think the more we bring this open spaciousness to it, the more we could actually uncouple our actions from these narratives or question whether the narratives, they may be true to a degree, but not true enough to actually help us with the, either the past or the future, and so we find something, some other way to be in the present moment. What that would be, that will come out of our ongoing collective practice together.
Wouldn't the present moment be different?
I mean,
what's
the
thing about your book about
specific
issues and
wondering
how you do that?
I think I'm asking about, that's why I phrase it in the way of difficult or painful thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think what John is saying is very right. At a certain point, you get to the situation where you can examine your narrative, whatever it is, with mindfulness. I think we still don't know how to get there. But I think the situation I'm talking about, people are unable to move from this very difficult, painful thought. And
well, the first thing to do is, it's not about moving beyond the painful thought, it's putting them on the table, putting the thoughts out there, and just holding them in awareness. And actually having maybe other people hear your painful thoughts. I mean, that is an extremely powerful sort of nexus for transformation and healing. Because in part, when there's a huge amount of pain associated with an emotional pain, one of the things that's really, really essential is for your suffering to be heard and understood by the other. Okay. And that doesn't cost anything. You don't need a government program to hear someone suffering. All you need to do is really get out of your own way and also listen and acknowledge it. You don't even have to agree with the narrative, but to be heard, to be met, to be felt is the beginning of the process of healing. So in a conflict situation, I know people have been doing that, have been working in that way for many years, but I think that's it. It's an incredibly important place to put more energy. So thank you for that question. Where is the other one?
I would just like to say, I just wanted to say a few words in the favor of pain.
In favor of pain?
In favor of pain, yes. In the last study session, I started to change my knee. And the first thing you thought of how to get rid of the pain. But then, a second later, we realized that it's just a state of sensation which really happened in the very moment. And then, the pain just became a bell of mindfulness. And it became so easy, I didn't have to struggle to get the very moment, because there was always something there reminding me of something that's happening now.
Absolutely. Let's just drop into that one. Thank you. I got asked a question last night, written out, and I think it's worth addressing at the moment. It was by a person who said, I'm a therapist and I'd like my help my client be less judgmental. But I find on this retreat that I'm just judging like crazy. So how can I possibly help my client be non-judgmental if I'm so judgmental? That's a wonderful, wonderful question. And I think it really drills down to the heart of what it means to be non-judgmental. So, you know, we talk about mindfulness being moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness. But if you start to pay attention to, you know, if you start to just sit, as we've been doing for a day and a half, how many of you have discovered that you're very judgmental? Just raise your hands. We've got ideas and opinions and judgments about virtually everything. So what does non-judgmental mean? Does it mean that we're all failures on this retreat because we're so judgmental? Not at all. What it means is that we are paying attention, putting out the welcome mat for all of our, how judging we are. And then we're not going to judge that. Or maybe we will, and then we won't judge that we've judged our judging. So it's an infinite regress. But it actually gives us an opportunity to rest in awareness of the judging and what we call, in common parlance, we suspend the judging. Okay, so we're aware that we are very, very judgmental, but then we suspend it in a certain way. We suspend acting on it, and we sit as if we're not so judgmental. And then we see what arises. So So that's really what it means to be non-judgmental. So yes, you can encourage your patients to be non-judgmental, and the way to do it is to be aware of how judgmental you are. So the more you focus on the judging, the more you actually see the actuality of it, and then the non-judgmental almost becomes like the way out. It becomes obvious that we don't have to attach to our judgments, and as soon as we're not attached to them, then it's a different story. They don't rule our lives. So it's, again, always a question of freedom. It's not like there's anything wrong with these judgments, it's just that they're not that useful. So if we cling to them as if they're the truth, and ideas and opinions and, you know, a lot of conflict, you know, is associated with judging oneself and other people. We have conflict inside ourselves. And so when we hold it in awareness, it's not like we're trying to suppress judging. We don't have to. The awareness itself is not tainted by the judging, and therefore might see new creative opportunities and openings, whereas before there was nothing but black and it's white. And we make a distinction in English between the words judging and discerning. Maybe you know about discerning, discernment, okay? So judging, I like to think of it as kind of black or white. It's very binary. I like it, I don't like it. I want it, I don't want it. This is good, this is bad. They're for us, they're against us. Do you know what I'm saying? So very binary, black or white. Discernment is seeing all the complexity between black and white, all the different shades and coloration between this way and that way. And the universe is much more that way than it is black and white, because everything is interconnected, and everything has pieces of the other inside oneself. And so to cultivate this, so being non-judgmental doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're being asked to get stupid. Okay, and then not have judgments, like, you know, I'm very spacious and non-judgmental, so, you know, and I understand that everything is one, so I can walk out in front of an oncoming truck and get run over, because, like, you know, essentially, everything is one. Well, you'll be dead very quickly. It's important to discern the actuality of things, and then not get caught in our sort of inadequate mental models or emotional kind of storylines about anything, including oneness or interconnectedness and so forth. If you really discern it, then that interconnectedness becomes, in some sense, the cardinal principle of the universe, and we can use that interconnectedness to try to optimize understanding and minimize those kinds of forces that go towards breaking things apart or fragmenting into us and them, when us and them are the same thing. When it comes down to human beings who, as the Dalai Lama likes to say, all want to be happy. You know, make it very simple. But still, it's like everybody comes out of mothers and bodies of women, and, you know, so the them over there and the us over here, it's, you know, 99% we're the same. The tallest black African and the shortest white American, you know, jockey riding horses for a living, you know, racing horses, their genetics, their DNA is 99.9% identical. 0.1% difference among all of these people who hate each other and, you know, fight. Yeah.
You speak about judgment automatically, and I think about compassion, and you didn't speak about the argument here, speaking about big mind, because when we judge, we automatically judge ourselves. And yeah. Then this is the second arrow that you talked about. So what's the part of compassion and loving kindness in this program?
You probably recall that I said at the very beginning that mindfulness that the word for mind in Asian languages and the word for heart is the same word. So when we're cultivating mindfulness, we're cultivating heartfulness, we're cultivating compassion. I'm a little bit allergic to how often the word compassion is used. I would prefer less talk about compassion and more compassion. Less talk about kindness and more kindness. But still, there are practices that can cultivate loving kindness and cultivate compassion. And loving kindness is a practice that we actually do in MBSR. Compassion is kind of the default mode of the entire program. I mean, you can't be doing this work without compassion, or if you are, you shouldn't be. So compassion is in how we greet people, how we say hello, how we are in relationship to them, how we listen, how we attend, how we communicate. So it's in the every aspect of it.
I meant more about ourselves, like seeing the dream from that position.
Yeah, so again, I've been emphasizing throughout the meditation practices a light touch, okay, with kindness, and that is the manifestation of self-compassion, that putting out the welcome mat for what's happening is an act of compassion. And it's also an act of recognition or assertion that we're strong enough to hold even the most unwanted. And this is, again, not only an act of compassion, self-compassion, but an act of wisdom. So kindness and compassion are completely woven into mindfulness. Nowadays, because people are, studying not just mindfulness meditation practices, but also formal compassion practices, people are tending to fragment into two camps. They're the mindfulness people and the compassion people, which I think is hysterically funny. They are the same. And there was a study that was published just this month from Northeastern University in Boston, where they developed very elaborate protocols. One mindfulness 8-week program, like MBSR, and one compassion. No mindfulness, just no mindfulness cultivation through practice, just compassion practices. And then they had a control group, neither. And this was developed based on sort of a Tibetan protocol. So the mindfulness practices and the compassion practices were matched. And so they like each corresponded to the other, but they didn't overlap. And then they didn't just ask people after they'd been through the 8 weeks of one program or the other or the control how compassionate you are, because that's so obviously open to bias. What they did was they created a scenario in the waiting room of the hospital where they had two people sitting in the waiting room with only three chairs. Two of the people were part of the experiment, and the other person was the person who was being tested, who comes into the waiting room to wait for, to go into the testing. And then a fourth person comes in, who's also a Confederate, and that person comes in on crutches, and obviously in a great deal of pain. And then the measure is, of course they're filming the whole thing, and the measure is, if you're trained in compassion, or you're trained in mindfulness, or you didn't get the training, you're in the control group, how frequently does the person get up and give the chair to the person in pain? Because the other two people, who are the Confederates, they're pretending the person doesn't exist, and they're not getting up and giving the chair. It's a beautiful experimental setup. And it turns out that the control group, let's say the control group was at like 20%, well, 15% of the time the control group gave up the seat to the person in pain. For the mindfulness group, it was 5 times greater. So 75%. I'm making up the figures. I don't remember exactly what they were. The mindfulness group gave up the chair 75% of the time. Now that's tough to do because when two people are not giving up the chair, you get this kind of effect where it has a technical term. I'm forgetting it at the moment, but it's kind of like when other people are not responding, you tend not to respond. Okay, the bystander. It's called the bystander effect. So when you know everybody's standing by and somebody's being murdered, you tend to not do anything if nobody else is doing anything. So here it's kind of like that. It's the bystander effect. So 75%, five times more frequently after 8 weeks of mindfulness training, you get up and you give the person the chair. And there's no compassion training in the mindfulness training other than the mindfulness, which is, of course, compassion, but we're not using the compassion language. And then in the compassion group, also the same. No difference between the mindfulness group and the compassion group. That says something about how ultimately these are the same. Sometimes skillfully it's valuable to have loving kindness practices or compassion practices for generating certain kinds of tendencies, but the mindfulness brings it out in a somewhat different way. So thank you for that question. Compassion is at the absolute heart, and self-compassion. In fact, as I said, I think just taking your seat, just sitting in the morning, say, is an act of self-compassion. Because we understand how turbulent the mind is, how turbulent life is, how much we feel pulled apart. Sometimes we say even eaten alive. And to take one's seat and actually open to the actuality of what's in our hearts and what's on our minds and what's in our bodies and hold it in awareness without fixing any of it, without trying to fix or change or rewrite a narrative, but to just hold it, it's a radical act of self-compassion. And, as I've been saying, a radical act of wisdom, and ultimately a radical act of, I don't even want to call it self-compassion, love. Love. But it's not a self-preoccupied love. It's something bigger, because we understand something about the personal pronouns and how we construct selves that are maybe useful, but too small. So one of the things that we can do is investigate how small our construct of ourself is and our narrative and our story, and then not create an artificial bigger story, but let the actuality of our being become the story as we grow, as we learn, as we heal, and as we transform, which in my vocabulary, transform means realize the actuality of who we really are, what the Buddhists would call our true nature, and then realize it, which means make it real in the world, not just as some kind of new story of how enlightened I am.